You know, part of growing up and maturing is learning to assess risk. I mean, this is what teenagers do, right? That ability to look at a situation and tell whether or not the payoff is worth it, or whether it might leave you in hospital with two shattered wrists, a smashed eye socket, fractured fingers and pelvis, and a broken jaw in three places. For Dominic Gordon, growing up in the inner west of Melbourne, every day was an opportunity for taking risks. Excitable Boy, Essays on Risk is his new book. Dominic, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks, Andy. How's it going?
I'm well. I want to ask you about how you see risk. What does risk mean to you now? Because I think it depends on how old you are as to the answer. But now, as you sit with me here, what does risk mean to you?
Well, it's interesting because I've recently gone through a big lifestyle changes. I've become a father in the last, my son's almost 2 months old now and I live with my partner. But 2 months prior to that, I was still, living in a way that I'd been living for so many years, which was, being quite alone and being, I was still using substances to deal with things. And so, risk has taken a reevaluation, to be honest. But in its truest sense, how I engaged with risk was, I guess, I didn't care about anything. I didn't really care. Like when I was young, it was the peer groups I was involved in. It was just a natural, because if you look at where certain, maybe demographics or where people are from, where I was growing up in the Western suburbs in the 90s, and it was just kids, they were just sort of all doing the same thing. And it didn't seem too odd that you would be smoking cigarettes at 11 years old and sort of, maybe setting fires here and there, or getting into, stealing and just all these little things. And it wasn't, to me, I never, obviously as a child, you're not going to have these reflective capacities, but to me, it was just a natural part of the environment where I was, which might've been different for other people. So as those behaviors progressed, it sort of just essentially sort of escalated, I guess. Risk really is about just blasting yourself into an experience without any real thought except wanting to get that, that high adrenaline and that danger. When I was 32, I had a big life event where, like you mentioned in the start, I had the big injuries with my wrists and whatever. And then I had a diagnosis about from ADHD and bipolar and stuff. But prior to that, my whole life was this big sort of chaos ball. And it was in my early 30s, I finally started to sort of grab hold of that ball and stop it from bouncing erratically all over the place.
There is nothing like fatherhood to stop that chaos ball. I definitely know what you mean there.
Yes.
Because you're not immortal anymore when you've got to look after your life.
Exactly. It's huge. Because it really was about it's just such a cliche, but it literally was. I was alone, this is in 2021. I was living alone in a flat, just like doing what I'd always done, broken up with my partner. And then I was like, hang on, what am I doing? I've been alone for so long. And I've got all this love to give. Like I've got quite a lot of love, and it would come out in all these weird ways and direct itself into unhealthy scenarios. But I thought, hang on, what about taking the biggest risk of all? And that risk was becoming a father. Like that's the ultimate, right? I mean, so that was the change. It wasn't, so from when I was young, it was more about sort of danger and escape and chaos and thriving in that chaos. But then it was now, it was about the fatherhood and everything that's come with that. And it's been, life, incredibly life-changing.
I want to ask you more about family, because reading your book, you were a fairly wild kid. You took up smoking at the age of 10. You stopped going to school in your teens. You list, various criminal activities. You've been to court a fair few times. Mm. But even throughout all of this experience, there doesn't seem to be any conflict between you and your parent and your family. What is your relationship like with them? I notice you mentioned them in the acknowledgements, in fact.
Yes, I know that's a very interesting point, because a review recently, a little short review in The Guardian that mentioned that I grew up, it says, Dominic Gordon grew up in poverty. And I was like, what the hell? I didn't, not at all. I mean, which is interesting because it shows you, given the behavioral, the stuff I was up to, people will obviously jump to conclusions about, you know, things that happened to me or, but what was always a constant in my life was that I always had a home to go to, and I had two parents, you know, they had their own issues, but I always had a place to go home to. And it was, there was always food. There was always love in a particular way, but it was there. That was a huge part of what saved me. I mean, because so many people I knew and grew up with didn't have that. I mean, if there was such a common theme in my life and when I was growing up, was that so many of my friends didn't have fathers, or their mothers were facing their own troubles. And a lot of my friends would come over to my house, you know, to have a meal. And so, yeah, there was always that safety net. And I put them through hell, you know. And Mum would just say to me, all I cared about was that you didn't go to prison and you didn't go to jail. You know, and I never did obviously end up in prison, but I ended up in hospital quite a lot. There was love. I mean, love, to be, again, the cliche is what, you know, gets you over the line and back into the human connection and engagement in the world in a healthier way.
Irrespective of what that Guardian review gets wrong, it also mentions that you were an obsessive nighttime kid of petty crime, meth use, and friends lost to drugs, prison, and suicide. He picks fights in libraries, visits glory holes in sex clubs, and tags trains at night. Anything else incorrect, biographically speaking, in that roundup?
Yeah, that's pretty correct. Obviously there's a piece in the book which is all about graffiti and the lifestyle. And I think, I don't know if a lot of people understand how involving it is. It's because when I wasn't at school, it took everything. It took like all my time. And it's, if you want to sort of become respected and acknowledged for your, you know, skills in the graffiti game, yeah, then it's, you need to have nothing else in your life. And it was just lucky I wasn't going to school and things like that. But yeah, it's basically correct.
If you've just joined me on RN Drive, I'm talking with the author Dominic Gordon. We're talking about his new book, his first memoir, based on his life growing up in the western suburbs of Melbourne. It's called Excitable Boy. One of my favourite descriptions you make is of a pickpocket at the State Library of Victoria. I wonder if I can get you to read that out.
When a seriously crispy thief starts coming into the library, I lose my rhythm. I see him when he enters, moving so quietly that the junky crunch is audible. A tightly coiled hunter, wearing three-quarter pants bunched up above the knee, knotted with a string pull cord. He's been coming into the library a few times a week to do the rounds. Today, he glides across the floor, arcs the perimeter, takes in the rows of desks, goes up the stairs and does the same thing, pausing now and then near a desk where an oblivious person has a handbag or a phone before moving on. To get a better view, he flies up onto the railing, perches there for a bit, sweeps the floor with salivating eyeballs, then flies down and keeps moving. A few steps later, he spotted an antelope calf struggling in the mud. He stops. I look around, but no one else seems to see him. The student has her backpack slung over her chair. I'm on the lower floor looking up. He's got his side eye working overtime, moves in, and just as the antelope's leg is bending double in the mud, she makes a startled, gurgling noise of recognition. Her study buddy appears, who notices the invisible junkie. He disappears the very instant he becomes visible, cover blown. I watch him ease down the stairs, arcing the opposite way, then he's gone. I've seen at least two wanted men and one wanted woman hanging out at the State Library at separate times, fresh off Crime Stoppers. It is a place for everyone, after all.
Such a wonderful kind of jungly, vicious description. You're obviously a fan of David Attenborough, I can tell. I've used to study in that library, the State Library as well, so I know the kinds of late night encounters that you can have there. I'm wondering, as a storyteller, as that moment was happening, is it literal in your mind, or is it the very act of retelling it and using your storytelling that makes it creative? How do you see it?
Well, when I saw him, he was so striking in his look. Like, he looked so damaged, like he had sort of waxy yellow face, like a big rat tail, and he just looked so damaged or so desperate. And to me, I think in my head, I did see him as some kind of animal, some kind of desperate animal. And then when I was writing it, it came out like that. It just came out as though sort of my imagination was sort of almost not fully formed about what I wanted to say in relation to him and the description, but it wasn't too far a stretch from seeing him to then putting what I put down, because I envisioned him as such an outsider that, yeah, you're right, jungly, like he's just in his own dank, dark world, and that's how I kind of saw him and saw him operating.
Speaking of other animals from the criminal savannah, what's a searcher? Tell me what a searcher is.
A searcher. Traditionally, it's emerged from Sydney. And so in the 90s, there was a type of style of theft. So young thieves would basically say, you just go roaming through the city. You go to the CBD and you just walk and wait for opportunities. Like say, for example, you'll go into a shop and what you're looking for is distracted employees, whether they're away from the till, so that you might get a chance to, when they're doing something, you can quickly jump over and press the no sale button, pop the till and take the money. Doing tills, they call it, that's part of it. The other part of it is, which I did quite a lot, was where you go to the back room of the shop. So like every shop has their place where the staff will keep their belongings, or they'll have like a room where they count money and just do like, you know, work-related things. And you look for that back room, and that's kind of what you're doing. And I would sort of get up and just, when I wasn't going to school, I'd have my backpack, gloves, I'd have like little implements and things like that. And just like cruise, like I'd go on trains and just get off in weird suburbs, walk around like Ashburton or places where there was, you know, like richer suburbs is where it was sort of where you'd go. I mean, you're looking for complacency. But yeah, it relies on that kind of quick instinct, constant. It's almost like you need to be a bit damaged. Because it's a hypervigilance par excellence. I mean, it's really, you need to have your head on a swivel at all times, because it's based off just constant, relentless opportunity seeking. When it came to Melbourne, when I started doing it, it's funny because I was about 18 and I met these two criminals from Sydney who are a lot older. They were like, so I was about 17, 18. They were like in their mid-20s. Well, it seemed like a lot older then. And I told them what I was doing and they had a name. Like before, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just stealing. And they're like, oh, you're a searcher. You're a little searcher lad. So it's like you're just out there looking, hunting for opportunity. And it's very specific to like burglaries and daytime like thefts and shops, but usually for cash, like you're looking for cash pretty much.
I know you love cinema and this is sort of like your happy place where you sort of feel the most relaxed. And I know that heist movies were an early favorite of yours and something in fact that you shared with your dad. It seems like, I don't know, you saw thieves and criminals as quite glamorous and sort of appealing. I wonder what your folks, if they're still with us, think about your memoir. Have you given it to them? Have they read it? What do they think?
Yeah, look, Mum, she couldn't read a lot of it, and she had a real tough time with a lot of the content, because I obviously didn't tell them, yeah, what was going to be in it. They knew some stuff, but it's funny enough, my dad seems to be, you know, he's almost quietly respectful of what I've done or achieved. Or I know my dad likes crime. I mean, we bonded over crime, you know, and I would tell stories about criminality, and I always felt that he respected that too. Like it's, and I don't want to make too much of a direct link between sort of the working class and criminality or the, you know, criminal classes, but there was like an acceptance, I guess. I was right on the cusp of internet, but no, I didn't know there was no internet really. And so, yeah, you had this kind of, I guess, connection through more old school mediums like films and books and things like that. And yeah, so my love of heist films blossomed out of my dad's own love of heist films. And we still, to this day, like if we're, you know, if it's a bit awkward, we've got nothing to say to each other, oh, what have you seen? Is Michael Mann? No, he's doing Heat 2. So that's always been part of our conversation since I was a kid.
I feel like I've learned a lot about you today, Dominic, and there's plenty more story in the book. I hope we haven't spoiled any of it for your readers. My guest today has been author Dominic Gordon. His book, Excitable Boy, Essays on Risk, is out now. Great to talk to you, Dominic.
Fantastic. Thanks, Andy. Cheers very much. Thanks very much.
been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.